Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, returning to the show from one of the most influential bands on me, DBS, Jesse Gander. But with him this time, he has brought, also from the band DBS, guitarist and brilliant painter and visual artist, Andy Dixon. And we have a fantastic conversation. More on that in one second. I'm excited for you to hear this. But first, if you want to get in touch with the show, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will give the message to me. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. Also, another pretty big DBS fan. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. I also play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. We will be going on tour, maybe coming to a town near you if you live in very specific places in the Southern Ontario, Eastern Seaboard of the United States kind of area. But we're going to be doing a lot more touring in the fall because we have a new record called Another Day. Check out the two singles from it, Stimming and Another Day. There's videos. You can find them on video watching services. I think there's Vimeo and there's YouTube. Please check out the Another Day video. I helped direct it, and it's a history of cannabis. A lot of research went into that for me. And yeah, check that out. Check out the cannabis episode of Turn Out of Punk 2 from a couple weeks ago. And that is that. Hopefully see you on tour. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, returning to the show, Jesse Gander from the band DBS, and bringing to the show with him, Andy Dixon from the band DBS. DBS is a band that, when I was a kid, seeing them on Much Music, on The Wedge, with Snowball, their video that got kind of a lot of airplay up here, relatively speaking, certainly for an independent band in Canada for that time. And my gosh, did it have an impact on me and Tristan, of course, who I said earlier, and all our friends. Like, actually, most of the kids I know, like, they were, as much as, like, Green Day was happening and Offspring was kind of happening at the same sort of time and on Much Music and in that kind of rotation, to see a bunch of kids doing it was just like a, I don't know, it was like a signal flare going off. And so many bands started in that kind of wake. And DBS kind of went and evolved and became a fantastically influential band, kind of going in more, I guess, screamo is such a co-opted term at this point, but taking a heavy screamo influence into what they did. And my gosh, they are a awesome band and a fantastic band. And if you have not checked them out, you got to check them out. Go back and listen to Jesse's first episode as well. They are, it's a great conversation. I could ramble on forever about DBS. I think I talked about it in the last episode, but one night I drank a bunch of Mountain Dew Code Red And it was like an American Mountain Dew Code Red, because back then Mountain Dew Code Red in Canada didn't have caffeine. And I got hopped up on it, and then called a bunch of friends, and we started a DBS cover band that night. Never played a show, never practiced. Caffeine wore off. And but I was hot to do this DBS cover band. Still am. I still should got to do this DBS cover band. All right, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Check out Jesse's Gander's recording. He has worked with a lot of incredible bands and has just, he's a brilliant person in the studio, a brilliant mind in music, and very affordable. And you can find out more information at jessegander.com. I'll have a link in the description, of course. And as I said off the top, Andy Dixon is a unbelievably brilliant painter, very well-respected painter. You can find his works hanging in galleries and stuff like that. Beautiful, beautiful paintings. Find out more information at andydixon.net, I think. Was it .net or .com? I'll have a link to that, too. He's also represented, in galleries and whatnot. You Google Andy Dixon Painter, you'll get a lot of stuff coming up. Beautiful stuff. All right, that is it. I'm not going to ramble on. I did a lot of rambling today about DBS. I'm holding back right now because I want you to hear this episode. But sit back, relax, and enjoy Jesse Gander and Andy Dixon on Turned Out a Punk. Andy and Jesse, welcome. Oh, Jesse, welcome back to Turned Out a Punk. Andy, welcome to Turned Out a Punk.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, you are, Jesse, I've already done this to you, but it was a long time ago. So at the risk of repeating myself, almost 10 years later, you guys are a huge influence on myself, and kind of, it was your band that I think inspired me to want to play music and set me on this course. So you deserve all the praise and all the blame for that.
Oh man, thank you. I mean, that's huge. I mean,
you brought lots of people joy, Damien. So that's great.
Well, a lot of people pain too. So once again, you also got to take the downside of this thing, but yeah, it's a thrill to have you on. And Jesse, because we found this out last time from yourself, and I went back and listened to your episode, Jesse, and there's a lot of stuff I didn't follow up on. So I'm very excited to follow up on some of this stuff with you now. But okay. Andy, let's go to you. How did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
I'm sure whatever story I have is going to be the exact same story that Jesse had, because we pretty much got it at the exact same time. We've been friends since like grade 4 or something like that, and started... I remember going to my first like all ages punk show. I don't know. I was like 11 probably or something. It was at a place called the South Wall in North Vancouver. I think, man, I don't know. Did Strain play that or something, Jesse? Do you remember that show?
BNU. It was BNU.
Yeah, BNU. Yeah, brand new.
BNU and Elvis Love Child.
Oh, and 10 feet tall or something? 10 foot?
No, they didn't. We actually never saw 10 feet tall. They broke up just as we were getting into them, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. I always wanted to, because they're from the same scene, and I love their tape, as did you. But we never saw them at South Wall, 10 feet tall. They played, I think they played the show before the first show we ever went to.
So maybe in my head, I saw a poster for it or something and like thought it was that show. Or something. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you know, I think getting into punk was like a natural progression from being like a little headbanger kid. And then, you know, you sort of get into less guitar solos and less technicality. You start hitting puberty and you start getting a little less into like fantasy dragon stuff and a little more into being angry about stuff, I guess. You know what I mean?
Who are 10 feet tall though? Like, you've stumped me with that one.
They were just like a Vancouver, kind of like a, well, actually, I don't even know, because I guess I didn't even see them, but they were in the same scene as BNU for sure. But yeah, that sort of style, I think, of like kind of hardcore, but not like chuggy chug, you know what I mean? I that's the way I remember it anyway.
Yeah, early melodic hardcore. People that were around at that time still revere them, you know, like the people who would know BNU or Strain or that kind of thing still sometimes speak about 10 feet tall, but they never made a full-length LP. They just did a 7-inch or two and a cassette or two. So I think they ended before they had a chance to kind of see the fruits of anybody who liked their band.
Jesse, were they on that, remember that compilation that had basically every good Vancouver.
Wade Free Vancouver.
Yeah. Exactly. Were they on that?
They were. And their song, it was great. I remember you and I both liked it. Actually, I wanted to mention to Damien, maybe, you know, have you heard of the book? It's called Scream Therapy. Have you heard of this book?
No, I don't think I have.
You should interview the guy who wrote it, Jason Schurz, because who Andy and I are talking about is a guy named Jason Schurz, who made a compilation that was influential to Andy and I when we were first getting out of metal and getting into punk as young kids, like grade 7 kind of thing. And he did a compilation called Wade Free Vancouver, which had, you know, BNU and Strain and 10 Feet Tall and Spark Marker and all the seminal kind of hardcore and punk bands from the early 90s sort of movement in Vancouver. And he just wrote a book that is the direct correlation between mental health and punk rock. And he's a guy from British Columbia. Yeah, he's a fantastic writer. He wrote the magazine in Vancouver that was called Terminal City. He was the music director for it during the time that Andy and I were teenagers. And Katie from Operation Makeout, my old band, just sent me this book for my birthday. It just came out. It's really popular. And he interviews punk rock people from all over the world, like all kinds of people from Black Flag and people from tons of cool bands. And yeah, you should really, you could edit this out of the podcast if you want, but you should really talk to Jason Schurz because he's a smart guy and he's a really nice guy. And he put out the second Wade Free Vancouver was called Wade Free Wherever. And he moved back to Powell River, which is like north of Vancouver, a small town. And so he included some other bands like Victoria Bands and some other BC bands. And DBS was on that. And that got us a lot of exposure early on, like before anybody else really knew who we were. And yeah, that book, Scream Therapy, you would love it. It's all short stories about mental health and punk rock. It's fucking awesome.
Well, that's the only thing I've picked up since we talked. Because you were like one of the first 20 people on the show. You did the show the first year, but... Yeah. Doing this show, I've realized like there are a lot of us that are drawn to this music. It's mental health stuff and ADHD, undiagnosed issues, or just, you know, we need it. And it does feel like that's not everyone, obviously, and not to put that on you if for either of you, but it does seem like that's something that seems to be a constant thread that runs throughout punk from the very beginning. That Wade Free, I pulled up Wade Free Vancouver. What a compilation.
Yeah.
And this is the book. That's the same guy who put it out, Scream Therapy. So it'll be probably reversed to you, but yeah, amazing book. It's like really inspiring. It's also gut wrenching. It's like a very, like, yeah, it's a very, very challenging read, but also it's an easy read, but it's hard hearing about all the people that suffered and how punk rock helped them. It's a beautiful book. I really highly recommend it to anybody, actually, or anybody who doesn't understand punk rock. I mean, this book kind of, it explains that part of it. Cause I mean, punk isn't always about mental health. It's about politics too. And it's about fashion and it's about obviously a genre, but yeah, like, you know, I think also like the scene that we were kind of into, like bands like BNU and 10 Feet Tall, they were kind of like, they were emotional, melodic hardcore bands, you know, they were kind of like, you know, they kind of represented that sort of angst, I think, that, you know, young people have.
It's an interesting period for Vancouver music prior to, you know, yourselves, and then I guess Smugglers were around before, but Smugglers blowing up and Gob blowing up, because it is, like you're saying, it is a really big scene and definitely respected internationally with Strain, Spark Marker, Brand New Unit, Face Puller. But it is like, it is almost like a sound when you kind of put all those bands together, weirdly.
I guess it was. It was so close to Seattle too. I can't help but like make that kind of connection to what was happening there. Not that it was identical, but Face Puller really, I felt like, even at the time, it felt like some kind of bridge between those two cities and sounds. Mm. That makes sense. I never really thought about, I guess at the when you're in something, you don't think about it being like a movement. You just think it's what all things are like, you know, it's only in hindsight that you're like, oh, that was like a moment that where things were happening. You know, when you're going to your first show and it is, you know, Spark Marker or whatever, you're just like, oh, this is what live music is. Cool. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then 15 years later, you're like, oh, wow, that was actually really special.
And also, yeah, putting in that geographical context too with Seattle and like Undertow and Resolution, mm-hmm, and some of those post-hardcore bands that were happening there, it is like in addition to what happening with grunge and all this stuff, almost like a second story of sort of melodic hardcore on the Pacific Northwest.
Definitely.
So, Andy, when you were on, sorry, Jesse, when you were on last time, you mentioned that you got your Sex Pistols record and your New York Dolls record from your mom. Was your mom going to shows?
My parents were probably, you know, they were, my oldest brother was born in 1969. So, you know, when my mom and dad were, you know, 18, 19 or whatever. So they wouldn't have been like young punks in 78 or anything like that. They were people, they were family people that had, you know, kids and stuff. And, but they were just really into all kinds of underground music. So like they love punk rock and they, you know, they have all the really, for example, like my parents have all everything by, you know, Dead Kennedys, some Black Flag, everything by Ramones, everything by the Cramps, you know, Sex Pistols, like they're obvious shit like that, you know, but they weren't necessarily, you know, like Minor Threat or like Embrace or like, you know, Bad Brains. I mean, they would have known who Bad Brains were, I'm sure. But, you know, like they weren't into the underground punk internationally speaking, but they were into the big national bands. But Vancouver, they like, you know, they saw DOA and Subhumans and you know, Dish Rags and all those kinds of early Vancouver punk bands. So, yeah, I was just getting into it. I remember there was a compilation that came out that was, it had Skid Row on it covering Holidays in the Sun.
Yeah,
and I thought that's an awesome song. So I was sort of like, oh, mom, these Sex Pistols. And she's like, oh, yeah, I got that record. Like, like my parents have one Iron Maiden record, not because they're like headbangers, but just because like, who doesn't have one Iron Maiden record? Like, really, you're into music and you've never even checked out one single Iron Maiden record? Like, you don't have the faintest idea who they are? Not possible. Impossible.
It was always fun having sleepovers at Jesse's place because his parents were into like cool shit that just seems so. I mean, my parents were accountants who like literally did not listen to music. Like, they just don't know what music is. I think my dad said his favorite song of all time is Total Eclipse of the Heart, which is a great song, but you know, that's about the extent of his knowledge about music.
It's not the
and
Cramps.
So I would go over to their place and they'd be listening to like Sisters of Mercy or whatever. While we're eating breakfast, like pretty loud too.
Yeah. Andy's parents who I love and revere, and Andy's dad being accountant is actually my accountant and has been and has saved me from bankruptcy my entire life. So no shade on Andy's dad. I love Andy's dad. And he's a very cool guy and a very open-minded guy, actually. And he's always allowed us to make all kinds of weird rock and roll and has never ever made anybody feel bad about it, to my knowledge. Although however, they have four A tracks, I remember. They have Bridge Under Troubled Water. They have Saturday Night Fever and the greatest hits of the Bee Gees, and they had Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles. Those are the four A tracks I remember seeing.
I'll add a fifth. They definitely had the Flashdance soundtrack. That was my mind. Yeah.
I just figured that was assumed, so I didn't bother mentioning it.
Well, you know, it's funny because here you are saying, yeah, my parents were into obvious stuff like the Cramps and it's not DOA. Parents are that's deep cut demo only shit for parents.
I guess that's true. Obvious to us, though. It's like, yeah, you probably know all the guys, the Dead Kennedys. You probably had them on the show. So, you know.
Well, yeah. I think you fall into one or two camps with that band these days. So I don't know everyone, unfortunately. But
Jello's cut me a check because I got to produce two Subhumans records when they got out of jail. That came out on Alternative Tentacles. So I got to get a check in the mail from Jello Biafra. That was really cool.
That's awesome. My dad was into cool music too. So I grew up having access to that stuff. And it's a real blessing. And I didn't realize it till I got older that like, oh, having like Nevermind the Bollocks in your parents' record collection is definitely like a leap ahead of everyone else starting out.
It's not the norm, that's for sure. It's certainly nothing I had. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had to get stuff from like, well, I have two older brothers, but they never really got into punk either. But I did have a close friend, Derek, and his older brother, Patty, was what, like, I remember he had Against the Grain on cassette. That was probably one of the first times I ever heard like that kind of punk, you know, like the Epitaph, mm-hmm. you know, the fast beat stuff. I think that was pretty much the first time. And skate videos too. I remember hearing like NoFX on some old 90s skate video and being like, what the fuck is this?
How much mm-hmm. awareness did you guys have, like outside of, you know, your parents maybe, but like of the sort of the history in Vancouver at that point, like DOA and Subhumans? Because it's kind of pre, that stuff getting rediscovered and a lot of those records getting reissued. So that stuff mm-hmm. pretty obscure at that point, certainly in Ontario.
I think that, you know, we were so young and so impressionable. We're like sponges for that kind of stuff. So I think like, we made an effort, a concerted effort to like check out DOA and stuff like that, even though, you know, they were older, they weren't exactly playing the South Wall or anything like that when we first got into that stuff. But I do remember like actively seeking out some more historic Vancouver stuff. Because yeah, you just want to learn when you're that age, you know, and like, especially stuff from your own city that people have heard of in other places is like pretty exciting, you know?
Yeah. I think also like with a thing like DOA, like it's pretty hard to be from Vancouver and not have heard of them because, you know, there's just stickers on everything and,
exactly.
and graffiti and like they have a strong presence, you know, and like, funnily enough, though, like, and DOA, who I do love a lot of records by, like, I really love Something Better Change in particular, like, it's the first one, and cliche to say, but I really do love that album. I think it's one of the better punk, of the original punk records in the world. I think it's one of the better ones, but the one I never listened to, even though I always wanted to, and we even opened for them when we were teenagers, was Subhumans, actually, and I never actually really got into Incorrect Thoughts until I re-recorded Incorrect Thoughts. I was the guy who Incorrect Thoughts was on a label, like a major label that went away, and they never got the rights back for it. So they re-recorded from scratch Incorrect Thoughts.
Okay.
Yeah, it was Taylor's version, exactly. It was the same thing. It was literally exactly the concept. And I did that for the Subhumans, and I was like, fuck, every song is good. And then at that point in time, I've now since listened to Incorrect Thoughts a lot as in its original state, which can be heard. And it's just such an excellent album. I think it is as good as, you know, like Minor Threat, Out of Step, or EMS, different, looks like the different genre, obviously, but subgenre. But yeah, just like politically and musically, that album is just, it's as good as Nevermind the Bullocks. It's better, actually, mm-hmm. from a songwriting perspective. So Vancouver has some really cool shit going on, but yeah, I don't know, like, I sometimes wonder if people know that outside of Vancouver, and I don't always have a sense of it. I think when DBS toured Europe, we got more of a sense of that because we were opening for DOA, and everywhere we went, people loved No Means No. Like in those days, No Means No were as big as NOFX in Europe. Like they were playing the same size venues that NOFX would play on the Punk and Drublic tour, you know, or that like that era of that band. So they were really huge. Mighty, they're from Victoria, not from Vancouver, but we claim them for ourselves.
Close enough. You're right. I'm like the iconography almost of like. That No Means No shirt, you know, the one with the guy hanging on it or the DOA shirt. That's like that just says DOA with the gun. Pointed. Those are like emblazoned in my memory before I had ever heard it. Probably like seven people at every show was wearing either one of those shirts.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Or the SFU shirt, which are Edmonton, but same. Yeah. Everybody had an SFU shirt.
SFU shirt. So good, the one that's black with just the white drawing of that, like, kind of
open up your mouth and say SNFU.
Oh my god, such a good shirt.
Anthony Kiedis is wearing the DOA shirt in the Under the Bridge video as well, and I know that we all love the Chili Peppers, and particularly, you know, when Blood Sugar Sex Magik came out, I mean, everybody loved that album. It was the most popular album of the year, and in the video for Under the Bridge, Anthony Kiedis is wandering around in a bright white DOA shirt. You can't miss it. You know,
so. I think Joey told us when we were on tour with them that they went golfing the day before they filmed that video, and he gave him that shirt.
Incredible.
That's awesome.
Funny enough, I actually live a few blocks away from what is reportedly the bridge of under the bridge of the Chili Peppers fame.
It's
right down the street. Yeah, yeah.
Damn. When I first went to Vancouver on a school basketball trip, I was the manager, not actually on the team, which means I just kept score and got people water. I listened to that tape the entire time. So I've got a strong Vancouver association with Blood Sugar Sex Magik.
Nice. Yeah, sure. I heard listening to that at Jesse's house on his Ghetto Blaster. Didn't Blood Sugar Sex Magik, Nevermind, and like Metallica's Black Album all come out in like within 2 weeks of each other or something?
Yeah, there's even like something else crazy in that same period. There's like
Use Your Illusion maybe or something like that.
Yeah,
I don't
know. To the Subhumans, that song Behind the Smile.
That's the song I love too.
Oh my god, the lyrics on that thing are like, whew.
That's the beginning of emotional punk, that song, I think, in that way, you know? Behind the Smile. It's an incredible song.
Yeah. And just like the way it kind of demystifies, you know, the world, but specifically being in a band and like the role that you're kind of forced into as a lead singer of a punk band, where all of a sudden, because like we were talking about earlier, like what is punk? It's a religion, right? And so all of a sudden you become someone's preacher or spiritual guide. And that song is like, no, we're just all bullshit. We're just all insecure people with this microphone.
Yeah.
But right. Brian Goble was a real legit guy too. You know, like he worked at the PHS taking care of people facing hard times, people on the street and stuff, right until the day he died. Wow. Very suddenly. And he's like, yeah, he made a massive impact on people's lives. Like he didn't just like sing those lyrics. He lived that shit. And I have the good fortune and honor to sing at his memorial of life. Actually, they put together a killer band with Ford Pier and other people. And like the drummer from SFU and stuff like that. And I got to sing one of the songs that I got to record for them when they reunited after they got out of jail because of political activism. You know, like Jerry Hanna went to federal prison for 15 years for activism, you know, very direct action activism, you know, the kind that not everybody can stomach necessarily. But, you know, at that time it was meaningful to him. So those guys weren't just like pretending. They meant it when they were singing about politics, which is more than you can say for a lot of bands. So yeah. Cool guy. Really cool guy.
Well, they kind of, I think that book Direct Action's about the Squamish Five.
The Squamish Five. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and even DOA, right? DOA is the band that kind of taught Black Flag how to do that touring thing. So, like,
it's not Minor Threat.
And Minor Threat, yeah, they taught everyone, right? Like, they are, those two bands are so key to the development of American hardcore and, well, I guess North American international hardcore.
Well, DOA coined the term hardcore, like Hardcore 81.
I was going to say, is that actually true? But yeah, I guess it is, huh?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I've heard that. It may not be true.
I've heard that too.
They were going to call it, there was a zine article or like a newspaper article that came out and it was saying LA's hardcore or San Francisco's hardcore maybe. And it was about these bands and their manager at the time, what's his name? I'm blanking on it. His brother plays in Mecha Normal.
Or something or, yeah, or,
he was like, a yippie guy and
I know you speak of it. I can't think of what his name is, and I didn't hear that he passed away, so it's not clear to me.
Okay, anyway, I'll fix that in the intro. But he was like, how about we call the album Hardcore 81, or I think it was Maximum Hardcore was the other title they were kind of going with, and then so they went with Hardcore 81, and yeah, the rest is kind of history from there. It's also, when you look at Toronto and the history of Toronto underground music, and I say this as a very proud Toronto person, Vancouver punches so much higher above its weight than Toronto does in terms of like consistency of bands. Like when you think of it in terms of the population, the amount of classic records that came out of almost every stage of Vancouver underground music, it's wild.
I never felt it's fully gotten the recognition it deserves for it, but I guess, or maybe it does, I'm not sure, but I agree with you. I'm proud of that myself. So, but I've never known if other people perceive that or not. But that's interesting that you do. I'm glad you do. I'm flattered. I mean, it wasn't up to me, but
I wonder why though. Like, I wonder if it's kind of a domino effect of just like one good band, like a DOA kind of, it creates a sort of ripple effect, you know, like the ceiling gets set very high and influences are flowing. And maybe because it's not as big of a city as Toronto, there's a kind of community is the wrong word, but there's sort of like a weave that goes through that, like one thing starts it and it kind of, you know what I mean? Like maybe in places where it's a little bit too big, it's actually harder to get people going or something. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of why there were so many good bands that came out around then.
I think it's also, there's like a trajectory for success in Toronto because it is like a music biz town. So a lot of bands would go metal or hard rock or new wave because you could potentially make it, I think.
Yeah.
Right. Vancouver has a long history of activism as well, like going back. It might be just because so many hippies and stuff flocked out here, people that were socially conscious. But like, for example, Greenpeace is from Vancouver. Adbusters is from Vancouver. The oldest vegetarian restaurant in Canada is in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. Like the Noms, been there since the 60s. This is like unheard of, you know. Like there's a lot of, and I think punk rock, you know, is all of those things and some other things too. I mean, New York invented punk rock in my mind. I mean, there's bands that were punk before punk, as we know, like Wayne Kramer, the MC5, rest in peace.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Stooges, whatever. There's plenty of examples of that, really obvious examples of it. But and New York invented punk to me. But yeah, there's just a lot of Vancouver sort of, I don't know, maybe it's just like a lot of people tend to flock up here because of the warmer climate and at Toronto and you know, as a place like also Vancouver used to be cheap. I think that's one thing that's like sort of been lost is that prior to the 90s, Vancouver was a cheaper place to live versus the rest of Canada. Like my friend James from Bison, he's a little older than me. James is probably about, you know, 50 or something. And he moved up to Vancouver in 89 when he was a teenager because Winnipeg was too expensive. He's like, I'm going to move to Vancouver where it's nice and cheap and the weather's better.
That's wild. Yeah. I think maybe to your point, Damien, too, that's a good point that like, maybe because it's not, it wasn't a very like industry city or however you want to say it, where there's sort of like, you're getting into music in order to get to a certain place. It creates this idea where you're making music just for the sake of making music. And maybe there's something really nice about being really isolated in the Pacific Northwest where you're not really, we never really, when we started making music, it wasn't like, oh, maybe we're going to sign to blah, blah, blah. And like, you know, it's just, we're just doing it. I don't know. It was just something to do with like put our energy into, put our creativity into. And maybe there's just something special about not really trying, you know what I mean? Like not thinking about a bigger grand scheme thing. And maybe there's no precedent set really, you know, there's no like, oh, if we do what that band did, we could get on MTV or whatever the goal, I don't know, whatever.
It's like what Jesse brought up too, though, that activism thing. And well, I guess you're definitely a part of this tradition too. Like there's an art anti-commercial, you know, doing it for the sake of the art, doing it for the sake of the political thing that I think, you see a lot more there than like you got Muma Da. What is that label? Muma La Da Records. 5440s was on it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know that one?
It's like, I don't know.
I don't know.
I'll send you guys Popular Front. They put in a lot of like really interesting arty, the artier side of new wave kind of records and post-punk stuff. And whereas in Toronto, we've got Martha and the Muffins. Like there's a like, doing it because it's important, doing it because it's art, not to undermine and market them up, but there's a path to success with them that I don't think these bands are necessarily pursuing in the same sort of way.
Exactly. Yeah.
And also you brought it up with SNFU and I guess no means no stayed in Victoria, but there also seems like there's a brain drain from a lot of places in the Western and the mid part of Canada to Vancouver. Like Biff Naked was talking about how she moved there at a certain point and like certainly SNFU relocates or Shy Pig relocates. And there's like it feels like there's a lot of people kind of going there. And certainly with the, I guess, draft dodging too in the 60s and a lot of the countercultural stuff, people moving up there. So it does have that real kind of, to this day, countercultural.
Totally. I mean, the Gulf Islands are still like that, right? Those are all like, a lot of it's still inhabited by old, like draft dodgers from, you know, 50 years ago or whatever. They're still there. Yeah. So it's
a lot of my friends' parents were draft dodgers or people were conscientious objectors. Like,
You know, we're using derogatory
slang. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. we're scum that came over here.
There's a difference though. Draft dodging was illegal, where conscientious objection, you might actually have been able to get off legally and also leave. Katie from Operation Mega Heart, leave her parents were conscientious objectors. You know, if you could prove you're a Buddhist or something, you might be able to move to Vancouver instead of going to Vietnam to die or kill other people.
Yeah. It's interesting how that also is what brings a lot of that weed stuff to Vancouver, I found too. Like a lot of the people coming back from Vietnam and bike clubs and whatnot, stuff getting moved across the border and it's a fascinating, it's such an interesting place to look at the history of counterculture and music there, because it does have such a strong history of it. And like you're saying, like so much international stuff that kind of arises from the scene there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you brought Mecha Normal last time. That's a band that I think is criminally underrated here.
Me too. Certain,
when you talk to people, like, they are hugely important to, like, a lot of shit.
One of Andy and I's first big shows, probably the first big punk show that Andy and I ever went to, we went to together, and that was Fugazi. I believe it was the Killtaker tour, and opening for them was Sparkmarker and Mecha Normal. Big $6 show with like 3,000 people there at the Plaza Nations, and we were handing out flyers for the first DBS show, which was June 4th, 1993. So, we were handing out flyers, and just given, we had like 400, you know, little handbills, or just like anybody. We weren't scared to talk to people in those days, you know, so we just go and up to people and talk and be like, come see our band. And then 200 actually did, you know, to our very first show. We had a great first show, 200 people came. And it was $2 or something, you know, it was like super, super cheap. And, but yeah, I love the Mecha Normal song, Who Shot Elvis? That's a song I just, that one. And there's another song on that record called Step Into My Sphere, which is like one of my all-time favorite songs. I've put that on a lot of mixtapes for people over the years, that song, because it's a very, very unusual and cool song. I don't even know what the song's about. I think that's what I like it. I just keep listening to it, wondering one day I'll get what it's about. Yeah.
Yeah, like I feel, and I think at one point, one of the guys from like one of those legendary New Zealand bands joins Mecha Normal too. And they've got like a connection to that as well. But they are, yeah, you talk to people in Bikini Kill, you talk to anyone that was kind of like abreast of underground music. They are like a hugely important band during that time period.
Well, also in like in 1990, like just like not that many women were involved. Like a lot of women were involved in the punk scene, seeing shows, but very few, comparatively to men playing in bands. And so even that in of itself was influential to people. Like there was really only like a few like bands that were comprised of women or femme people in Vancouver in those days. Now I reckon it's equal or pretty close to it. I'm sure I'm wrong. Maybe someone would want to correct me, but to my perception of it, which is not all encompassing, I'll admit, there's just so many women in the scene now. It's completely refreshed the genre and made it not that stale thing it became around the time that DBS broke up, in my opinion. So I think that's also maybe also why Andy and I stopped wanting to play punk of that style, is that it did sort of become, I mean, I think it was able to be pushed forward, but at the same time, there was a real sort of corporate staleness to the whole thing, which I think has been revitalized now, and particularly in my opinion, in Vancouver by young women and just LGBTQ2+A people as well. And neurodivergent people, and, you know, just people that are a hell of a lot more diverse than back in the sort of suburban pop punk days that we participated in. So yeah, I think that's a cool thing. It's made me actually like punk again, because I didn't listen to much punk outside of what I was recording or maybe playing from time to time for about a decade or more. But now I'm like actively like stoked on the genre again in a way that I hadn't felt that way since my 20s. So yeah, kind of cool.
I think also looking at the history of Vancouver, I think Vancouver was a more diverse scene in terms of gender, and going right back, it seems, than like a lot of other punk scenes, like Dish Rags coming to mind immediately, Female Hands.
Of course.
The Mission Hold.
It's Mission Hold and
yeah.
A Cub. And,
mm-hmm.
But I think what happened definitely post, not even necessarily post Green Day, but post kind of Epiphat explosion, is like that snowboarding kind of pro punk.
Yeah, that the Pennywise Boys Club sort of kind of feel to it, you know, very bro-y sort of, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I feel that, like, that's my on-ramp. So as much as I'm trash talking, and I'm also a product of it in a lot of ways. But at the same time, I think looking back on that Snow Job tour, that would have been a real interesting tour to be on, because I think you guys would have been seeing the coalescing of that kind of scene.
Yeah, that was
going north.
Well, it was wild, man. It was a weird tour for sure. I mean, we were touring with Blink when they were called Blink, you know?
Yeah,
I mean?
Blink 182.
They added their first. Yeah. They were like the same sort of, like, I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, Jesse, but I think, you know how on a big tour like that, you often have your kind of like partner band where like you switch places, they were around our popularity or whatever. So each night, take turns on the roster. It's just interesting. And I think there was that band who turned into Simple Plan.
Reset.
Reset. Yeah, they were on it. Yeah, that was starting to go into a territory I didn't really
bouncing souls.
Yeah. Well, we were actually your DBS, my old band Promise Kept, and Reset were all supposed to play a show at Classic Studios, but you guys couldn't make it, and sure. I ended up playing with Reset at that show.
We couldn't make it?
No, it was like it was not Classic Studios. It was at Club Shanghai.
Oh. And, in Toronto?
In Toronto, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was Reset.
I don't remember missing many shows. We did it. That was. I'm surprised we missed a show in Toronto. I wonder what happened.
I'm trying to remember the details of it, but we ended up going up and doing a DBS cover set.
Oh, I've heard about this. I've heard the whispers of this.
Well, that was my first DBS cover band. I've subsequently started to cover set, I should say. I've subsequently tried to start an actual DBS cover band for a number of years, but I have yet to bring it to completion. But one day, I will make you guys awkwardly watch me do impressions of you on stage
on Halloween. I sang in a Descendants cover band for Halloween, and it felt so good. Yeah. I loved it so much. I was just like, I got to the end of the set. It's it's actually with Paul from DBS on drums and Mario from the Real McKenzies on guitar. And then one of my best friends in the whole world, Barry, who plays in my band Updates with me. We did a Descendants cover set. Our band is called Coverage. And we did it for Halloween. And I just like, I hadn't like just sang since the last DBS show. I've always played an instrument in band since then, keyboards or bass or guitar or something. And it felt so good to be like liberated of the mic. I mean, you know what it's like. You just did this the other day, Damien, but it's like, it felt so good. And then I started to think to myself, you know, the only thing that I'm sad about is that these aren't my songs and I didn't write them and it's not my band. You know, so I was like, if it was and I wasn't the Descendants, I'd be super stoked to hit the road again and do it. I was like, it completely revitalized my thing. But alas, those are not our songs. Yeah.
Well, you're my Descendants. Milo, man. Jesse.
Thanks, man. I try.
Yeah, that Snow Job tour, like a key tour for me as a kid, going to those shows and seeing those bands. And it's interesting because it's a lot of different genres of punk, but all kind of within the same periphery. But knowing now more about you guys and knowing kind of the world you came out of, it must have been like a kind of an alien experience to be on something like that.
I think so. I mean, I had a blast. I mean, it was super fun. I look back on it fondly, but I definitely felt like, just a sense, I think alien is a pretty good word. I just feel like it wasn't necessarily our thing, our scene of the rock. I don't know. I don't want to say like that, but like we were so used to a certain kind of thing. Like our tours sort of had we knew what the kinds of people that we would meet at our shows, and we would tour with bands that kind of had a like-minded kind of ideology or ethos or however you want to say it, or even sonically a similar sound or something like that. And I think Snow Jam was just one of our only kind of big tours, and and there were so many bands. It's like, you know, it's not, I mean, I don't know about you, Jesse. I felt it was like a real kinship with Bouncing Souls. Thought they were like a really fun band to play with. I really loved watching them. They were the only band I actually watched every night.
They were the best to me as well. Yeah. And like, I think so fondly of that as well, Andy, that I actually went and saw the Bouncing Souls live about 2 months ago. I hadn't seen them since we played with them on that tour, which was 30 years ago or 28 years. Like that was 1995. And now it's 2024. I guess I saw them in October, which is 2023. So I haven't seen the Bouncing Souls in 28 years. And I went and they just played where you played, Damien, the other week. They played the Rickshaw in Vancouver. Yeah. And my wife also grew up listening to the Bouncing Souls and loves them as I do, and one of my best friends. So we all went, and it was shocking how they are exactly the same fucking band. They look exactly the same. Like you know, they all look young. They're all in great shape. They sound and play with the exact, like they were never very, you know, that guy's always kind of more of a loungy sort of singer.
Yeah, they're kind of bouncy. Like, I mean, it's a perfect name for them. They kind of do bounce. They're not like a thrashing all over the place. They have this kind of boppy, I don't know.
It's They're really good. I had a great time at the show, and I saw a lot of other people I hadn't seen in a long time. And I was just like, fuck, man. I was like, these guys, A, they're still a good band, and B, these guys have brought a lot of like good times to people over the years. Like, totally. They brought a lot of happiness to the world. And I don't think we can say that about everybody's influential. So I had a wicked time. I really like them. I checked out their new record too, which had a couple of good songs on it. Too much auto-tune though. They got to turn the auto-tune off. I like the way that guy sings auto-tune. I always thought it was cool that the Bouncing Souls were auto-tune. This Blink-182 was always in tune. They didn't need auto-tune. They were already a pop band. But like Bouncing Souls, they cranked up the auto-tune to 11 on it. You're just who's this for? I don't know.
I love Bouncing Souls, but I wish that guy sang in key.
Yeah, like, I wanted the auto-tune. That's the cool part. You know, like, that's where the magic lies. In the room, you know? But anyway.
I feel like the vocal style is like a bit like, if I remember correctly, like not necessarily like hitting a note. It kind of has an arc to every note, like a guy from Fugazi sort of like yelp.
Like glissando.
So it just seems very strange that you'd want to lock that into like a solid note.
It was robbed of its glissandos. Its portamento had been removed.
Okay.
And it was just like, why? Who's this for? It's not for, you know, I don't know. I didn't get it, but the songs are good.
I love his voice because it does kind of like, it's like the American Marky Smith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where it's kind of like speak singing, but like.
It's kind of narrative, right? Like he's telling you some kind of story for every time.
And the songs kind of are like that. I really mm-hmm. really like that band. It's cool. I love their show.
That's when I first got into them on that tour too.
I think there was a night, Jesse, where we were in Montreal and we were all quite drunk. That tour was really fun because you only played every second day. So there was one day where you just get to see the bands if you wanted, drink it backstage, whatever. And one night we ended up like wandering through the streets of Montreal, and we found the Music Plus Speaker's Corner. And I think with us and Bouncing Souls, if I remember
correctly,
someone else, and we all sang Motley Crue or something. We all sang Home Sweet Home.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never know if that ever aired, but I know we did that. I don't know if they ever aired it, but those guys are fun to hang out with.
We played with them when they were a tiny band before that tour too, Andy. We played with Bouncing Souls in Seattle at a tiny club with that band from Wales, the Cowboy Killers. We played with them in
1994.
Yeah.
What? You guys play with Cowboy Killers? Cowboy Killers did an American tour is the other mind-boggling thing.
We played with them in Wales. We played with them in Wales, and we got pierced by them in Wales. Me and Paul both got cheek piercings from the dude from Cowboy Killers, who was a piercer. Yep. But we also played with them before. And we played with them at a tiny club. I don't remember, but it was Bouncing Souls, Cowboy Killers, and us.
Remember that. Actually, when we were in Wales getting pierced by that guy, I had just seen a dude at a show that had like, what do you call it? Like the surface piercing, where it's like two studs and a kind of like a slightly looped, but like a slightly curved bar, so it'd be like two dots somewhere. And I saw he had almost like a tear tattoo right there. I wanted it so bad, and that's the one. He was like, "I'll give you guys all free piercings," and I was like, "Hell yeah, I'm gonna get that." And he wouldn't do it. He was like, "It's too close to your eye. You could go blind. I'm not gonna do it." And I was so bummed at the time, and now I'm quite grateful that did not.
Also in Wales, we saw a guy put a cigarette out on his penis. Do we wish to reshare this story? Damien, you know the story?
I remember that.
So the show's over. We open for DOA. We play with Cowboy Killers. Cowboy Killers and DOA in their hometown of Cardiff, Wales. And I'm drinking a beer. I'm drinking a Boddington's, and it's half done. I'm just sort of waiting to load out. And this guy's just like, "Hey, man, buy me a beer." And I was like a local guy. And I said, "Oh, no, I'm broke, man. I'm on tour. I don't have the extra money to buy you a beer." And he goes, "Oh, come on, man. I'll put a cigarette out of my knob if you buy me a beer." And I was like, "Well, I don't really want you to do that." And he's like, "Well, come on, man. Just give me that half your beer. I'll put a cigarette on my knob." I was like, "Okay, look, man. I'm like, just take the half the beer. I don't care. This is warm. Anyways, you know." And then all of a sudden he goes, "Oh, cool, man." And then he pulls out his knob, which is just covered in scars, and like cigarette scars. And he just like puts a big dray out of it and extinguishes the cigarette on his penis. And I'm like, "Oh, thanks, man. I guess. I don't know. Like, thanks for doing that." We're loading out our gear afterwards. He's this total like punk guy. And then we're loading out our gear afterwards. And now he's standing on the sidewalk as people throw money at him, and he's setting his pubic hair on fire. So
he's got a Jim Rose Circus Sideshow in his pants ready.
Yeah, Wales edition. Yeah.
Wow. Wales does, especially like Swansea, kind of have a like that sort of Vancouver tragic drug thing going on a little bit too, I found.
Why are you suggesting the guy that put the cigarette out on his penis was on drugs?
I would hope. I would hope he's on something to numb that pain.
Yeah. At least Tylenol. At least Tylenol. At least something like that. Wasn't too cool.
That is wild. That is oh, that's so awesome. Like I love the stuff in Wales. I love that punk scene there. It's also there's like it's like part of the second language scene in Europe where there's like Basque bands, Welsh bands, like there's a bunch of minority language bands in Europe that are all kind of like weirdly connected by the fact that they're minority language speaking.
Right.
Griff from Serpu Furry Animals was talking about it when he was on the show. And yeah, I love going to Wales. What a beautiful
cool place.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Very cool. That's the last time I've ever been there, actually. Was this one I've seen there. I put a cigarette on his penis. Last thing I saw. Yeah.
Well, you don't need to go back. You've seen it all.
Yeah, I feel like, what am I going to see next time? I mean, what's the point?
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Well, that's the thing. It's like you guys are coming from a scene where you're playing with these kind of bands. You know, you're from a scene where Submission Hold's from, you know, like there's but there's also at the same time, like the rise of Blink-182 and like you're saying, pre-Simple Plan and sort of this period where punk is getting to its commercial peak at that point as well. So it's like the story of kind of two punk scenes happening at once in the 90s.
Totally. And I feel like we were young and impressionable and probably like interested in both sides of that coin. I was anyway, you know, I mean, I didn't not like Green Day, you know what I mean? But I also liked Submission Hold. So I think we were sort of had a foot in both of those worlds in a way. I mean, I think the rise of Green Day at right around the time we started kind of being a band is like how we ended up on Much Music and stuff like that. Kind of, we sort of accidentally caught this wave that it's really interesting to look back on because we weren't necessarily trying to catch that. I wouldn't go so far as to say we weren't not trying to catch the wave. I don't think we were aware of the wave. I don't think we knew that was a thing that was happening. Like I said, we're so young that it just like, oh, here's a band. This is what music sounds like. This is what it's like to play. We had no reference. I mean, you know, we're so young. We just started going to shows. So it's like, it's a way you can just sort of like end up in places you didn't think you might be, you know?
Well, it almost seems like the wave comes to take you. Like you.
That's
guys
what I mean. Yeah, totally. It's not like we were like, oh, let's study how Green Day did it and do that, you know, but I wouldn't say I would say they were kind of an influence for sure. I mean, I love Kerplunk and yeah, like I said, I mean, I just thought that's what music was. I didn't really think like, I guess what I mean is like when you're 14, I don't know if I saw that much of a difference between Green Day and Submission Hold. It's it was just like bands I saw at the cell phone, you know what I mean?
And also to say something, I mean, Green Day and Submission Hold were from the same scene originally. You know, Green Day got caught up in a major label wave of signing bands. I mean, Green Day was from the Gilman punk scene. Like they were from the anarchist DIY punk scene. You know, I think there's still a part of them of that that's in there. Like I saw like a footage recently of them playing in the subway or something. I listened to the new Green Day single. It's actually, that sounded really good. But yeah, like I think also, yeah, you never really notice you're in any kind of you know, a cultural movement or something until you look back on it, and we certainly did it. And I think like I think that maybe we got caught in a bit of that wave, but also like I think it was just too like, you know, we had a lot of, you know, we you know, Andy's a guy that just seems to have a endless amount of creativity and is always doing something artistic, whether it be visual or music. And I'm just kind of like, I think I'm just like a really hardworking guy. Like, I don't know if I'm a deeply creative guy, but I'm a very committed guy to the things that I do. So I think those two things and also Paul, our drummer, like, is a really loyal guy. Like, Paul, if you ask him to be in your band, he will always be at band practice. Like, he will never fucking flick on you. So I think just between the three of us being childhood friends and all of us having just a slightly different personality to bring to a band, we kind of made a pretty good fit of being a band that made a lot of records and played a lot of shows and stuff. We were able to get that together.
I 100% agree. The kind of creativity I had didn't necessarily have like a focus. I definitely remember you being like, okay, let's book a studio. Let's record these songs. And I was like, what? That's insane. What are you talking about? You know what I mean? Uh-huh. But you were always the driving force for getting shit done, booking tours. And I was like, we're going to go on tour. Mm-hmm. This is crazy.
And that's how I became a recording engineer in the end was because of me being like, I got to record our demos, you know, so that we know what we're doing when we go in the studio and hang out and make sure the record gets done properly and just spending all that time in studios. All of a sudden, I just kind of knew how everyone went to school, right? I just all of a sudden is new. And I mean, for that matter, Andy was doing tons of artwork for us all the time, too. Posters. Exactly. And he was already doing art long before. Andy was doing art before we were even friends since he was a little kid. But still, obviously that applied. all album covers need art. He didn't do the
He got into art. I mean, Jess was saying, I was always kind of a doodler and I really liked visual art and comic books and stuff. And then, the punk scene comes around and I'm really enjoying making the flyers and making our album covers or patch design or t-shirt design or whatever. And that just sort of took on a life. And then once other bands see what I do, then they're kind of hiring me, you know, like, oh, pay you $100 for a t-shirt design. And then I'm kind of like accidentally a graphic designer 15 years later designing people's stuff. You know, it's interesting the way that all our, what we were into sort of like being in that band was sort of like a jump off point for us. You know what I mean?
Well, that's what it feels like punk is for people. Like, no matter what they wind up doing, like, this is the first place you're given permission to kind of do it. In a real way, like a professional way, as a kid.
Totally. Yeah, I agree.
When you said brought up about Green Day earlier, I find it interesting because they're definitely part of the Gilman scene. And when you look at the punk explosion as it kind of happens, it's almost like a rolling wave on the west coast of America south, where Nirvana explodes, Green Day explodes next, then it's the Offspring, and then San Diego with Blink 182. But it seems like as it kind of goes down, like the culture changes. So like, you're right. Like Green Day is part of that world. And not to say that Blink isn't connected to that world, but like there's a different vibe that kind of begins to come into punk as the 90s go on. And I think it's fascinating because you mentioned Reset. Reset kind of went with that wave, you know, become Simple Plan and really chase it. At the same time, you guys, at least from the outside, seem to formally reject it. As you kind of shift sonics.
I think so. It felt a little embarrassing, if I'm being honest. I think there was something like a little corny about that end of the wave. And I don't mean to shit on Blink. I actually still kind of like them. But but there was this kind of like, I don't know, lyrically, you know, it lost all sense of urgency in politics. It kind of became about girls, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with a song about a girl, I guess. But I don't know. It just felt like it felt a little manufactured or something. I don't know if it was. I don't know if I want to put that intent on Reset. I don't know if their hearts were in it. I don't know how you gauge that, but it didn't necessarily feel like it was coming from the most honest place or something like that. Maybe that's just me projecting my own, you know, 18-year-old cool guy on it and being like, oh no, you know.
Well, I think
like it's too easy to like, or I don't know, you know, but.
Well, yeah, like, No Pants, All Balls, I believe is the name of their breakthrough major label.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
It's definitely a completely different vibe.
Yeah, there was that temple silly tangent of pop punk that like sort of like Fat Mike might be responsible for, but the way they did it feels really different to me. It feels like a little less frat or something like that. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. Fat Mike just seems like a funny guy. And then And then you come, and then Blink 182 comes out with "Take Off Your Pants and Jacket" or whatever, you know. And you're like, okay.
Yeah, I think then, also like we were all. I think also we were both people that, or everybody in our band, Paul, especially in particular Paul as well, to speak for him. You know, we were all people that also liked a lot of different music, and as we got more into the scene and discovered more music, I think our tastes became more obscure a lot, not less. Mm-hmm. And we always tried to play music that was that we would want to listen to at the time, you know. So as some bands were becoming more commercial, and maybe that was maybe their heart, like Andy said, maybe that's where their hearts were, was making a more commercial sound for punk, and they felt good about that, and that's totally fine. We like some of the songs too. I like some Blink 182 songs. We all do, but it's just like but for us, we were getting into the more obscure sides of punk and hardcore. That became more
influential. Yeah, if we're making music that, would, like you said, we would mm-hmm. actually want to listen to it. There was no end game at all. I think that's an interesting thing looking mm-hmm. back, because there was literally no game plan or end game at all. It was just like, I got really influenced by this weird noise band, or like fucking His Hero's Gone all of a sudden or something. Yeah. And I like add like a weird, like detuned, like hardcore part in the song just for fun. I don't know. You were just kind of fucking around. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting to listen to, because we started this band when we were like 12 or whatever, and then ended mm-hmm. around 2020 or whatever. It's interesting to like listen to what we did chronologically, because you can literally hear the influences, because no one listens to the same style of music when they're 12 that they do when they're 20. And it's such a big, like, impressionable age, and you're such a sponge for stuff that, like, it's really, I can hear every album that I bought like that month, you know, come out in a song. I'm like, oh, this is when I discovered Braid, and I want, you know, and this is when I discovered, you know, whatever. But you can like, I can like literally hear these influences like come in as we get older. I think maybe when you're older and you're in a band, you're like you're less impressionable. Like you might hear a hardcore band and be like, that's cool, but we're not a hardcore band, so I'm not going to do that. But I think when you're a kid, you're just like, oh fuck yeah, let's do that too. Let's chuck that in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it makes me think of two comments I have about it. What, I mean, one is that we probably were cognitive that if we didn't do that, we could have been more successful. If we just stuck to playing Snowball over and over again, probably that would have garnered us more fans and success. So it's not that we were too aloof to realize that we were maybe quote unquote sabotaging our own career. But we didn't care. I think that was the thing. Yeah. We weren't doing that to begin with, because like Andy said earlier, we were just wanting to jam, to make music and release some creativity and all those things, and to do that. The other point I was going to try to make was I forgot now, so my mind.
I think to what you're saying, you know, and I haven't thought about this, but I think that another thing about kind of being involved in this very sort of tight scene, we've been talking about the Vancouver scene this whole interview, and I feel like our sphere, it was so small that it's like I guess I could have thought about like, yeah, if we just played Snowball, then maybe we would bust out of that sphere and you know, bigger things would happen. But I was like really happy in that sphere, and I was thinking about when I was, if I write a riff or something, I was thinking about that sphere. You know what I mean? I wasn't thinking in like a bigger thing. I was like, oh, I bet Matt Smith is going to love this riff or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking about literal, like the 100 people that went to our show, and they're my measuring stick for if like this is a good show or not. So I'm not even really thinking outside of that bubble basically that we're in, you know? And I think it yielded some really interesting results, because we were only thinking about like the next show at Sealand, and if we're going to play this new song, and what those specific people are going to think about it, rather than like how we get a meeting with a major label and what kind of music we'd have to make to have more people hear it. I didn't even, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really important to kind of remember that too for yourself. I mean, I find like I work in a field where, you know, my objectivity about music is called upon at every moment of the day. That's what I do, is I help people make their records hopefully sound cool and be cool. And I just I always remember something that Brian from Japandroids always says this to me, like whenever we're working together in the studio on records, he's always just like, if anything doesn't sound cool to us, we don't do it. And if anything does sound cool to us, even if we think other people think it's lame, we do do it.
Yeah.
And that's always his philosophy. Like if we don't believe in ourselves, and he's a guy that has lots of times where he doesn't believe in himself. He's an insecure artist like the best of them. But yeah. He's always like, if we don't believe in it, it doesn't go on the fucking record. Period.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas I think some artists probably try stuff because they think people will like it, which is a different way of making art, and one I can't really relate to growing up in the punk scene, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Brian's always like, we like Husker Du, we like Guns N' Roses, we like Metallica, it doesn't matter. We can like all those things at once. We don't have to choose. Yeah, he's like, we can be any of those. This project could be any of those things. It's up to us.
It's funny how it does become limiting on you on a band. I guess, you know, expectations are for the old kind of vibe, because like you then become like, oh, am I, because there's nothing preventing you from like putting like a fucking rap song on a record. You know, there's nothing that really prevents you from doing whatever the fuck you want, but yet there is sort of this expectation you have for what the people in your scene or people that like your band want or expect from your band. And you wind up getting caught in that in a weird way.
Totally. I think we had a healthy dose of like almost a push and pull of expectation. So I think like in some ways when you're young, I mean, you want to belong, right? I mean, that's part of being young. You want to be involved in something, a part of something. And so there is this desire to kind of make something that would put you in a specific ring or a specific world. But then there's this punk part of you that's like, as soon as you start doing that, you're like, no, I want to do exactly not this, and like push against it. And I think that's been was a driving force with our band like the whole time, is that there's this sort of like, we kind of want to be, I wanted people at our shows to have a good time, but I also didn't want to just like pander. And there was always this level of like, let's make something that is unexpected, or let's do something that isn't what would put us into a very specific place. Does that make sense? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I told Jesse this last time, in my neighborhood where I grew up, where my brother and I grew up and all our friends, you guys are were the Beatles to us, you know? And so like at every stage, like, remember, like we're all got super into you guys, and so we're all trying to get the striped shirts. Like, let's get a striped shirt, like the Snowball video. And it was like the quest to find that striped shirt. And like, my mom found one at this store. And then you guys showed up to play that in store at Rotate This the day before Snow Jam. And it was like that scene where Wild Stallions get out of the future time machine Bill and Ted's. Cause like, you guys got like dyed hair and crazy necklaces on and like piercings now. And we're like, oh shit, okay, this is what we're doing now. So everyone's buying like toilet chains and putting crazy necklaces with Sailor Moon charms on it because Paul had it on or something.
And like, on the other hand, like, it's cool. We were dicks because, though, too. Like, you go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say we were punishers.
It's nice to hear because I feel like I have this like feeling, I couldn't help but feel sometimes that like, because it takes so long to write a song and then practice it and then book the recording time and then record the album and then wait for it to come out, that when you're young, I mean, a year is like the difference between when you're 14 and 15 is huge. And now we're into this other thing and we're writing these new songs. And by the time an album would come out, by the time we're playing for someone that it knows, you know, what we're supposed to sound like, we kind of don't really sound like that by the time we go on tour. And so it's nice to hear that, like, that wasn't necessarily always a bad thing.
Well, it's funny because, like, yeah, like I said, like, the difference between being 14 years old and 15 years old is 1/15th of your life.
Exactly.
You know, like, that's a lot. That's
kids back then.
Yeah. So it's like, but I remember, like, just a couple of times, though, like, and it's cool that we were like, fuck it, whatever, this is something new. But on the other hand, we're such dicks sometimes because, like, I remember this bump show in particular really rings out to me. But it's, and I think that Damien alluded to this kind of vibe, is that, you know, we finally make a new record, you know, after another year, and we work hard on that. And then we go, and Winnipeg was always a very good city for us. Like, 400 people would come out and see us in Winnipeg. Like, you know, like 200 people would see us in Edmonton, 200 people would see us in Calgary. That was really good. But 400 people come to Winnipeg, and Winnipeg, as you know, it's really kind of, it bats above its weight as a city. It's always had some cool artists there and a lot of political activism and cool shit.
Great film.
But we play like Tales of the Crypt's only been out for a fucking year or a year and a half, and Snowball's been played a million times on Much Music, and we came and we did a whole headlining set and just didn't play that song.
Yeah.
Just like the song that 400 people wanted to fucking hear. We were like, oh, no, sorry. We moved past.
Yeah, it's when that push and pull thing that I was talking about like goes a little too far the wrong way. I also remember playing in Winnipeg like years later, and we got an encore and everyone was screaming Snowball, and we played like a Muzak version of it. We played like this really like jazzy.
Just like a bunch of assholes, you know, but we didn't know. We just were like, oh, no, we moved on. Sorry, screw you, you know. Thanks for paying, but it was only $5 anyway, so fuck you.
Totally. It somehow felt impossible to do it. Like, it felt like like doing a job. It was like, I can't do it, man. I can't play these chords.
And then the next time you came through, you guys lived in Toronto for like 2 weeks, and it was with a band that we shouldn't bother mentioning, in Falling Sickness. And you guys played like every day here. That was a huge, oh my God, I don't mean to make this about me, but that week, what a fucking week for me as a kid.
It was a cool week. I remember that. Yeah.
I forgot about that. Yeah. That we stayed at, this weird, was that when we stayed at that place? It was like a storefront in the front. And then there was like an apartment back. Man. Yeah. I remember that. I think they might've been called the Shuttlecocks. And I think there was a few women in that band.
Yes. Cool. My really good friend, Allison Baker, who lives in San Francisco and plays with the Kids in the Hall now and all that sort of stuff, was on guitar. Cool. And yeah, huge shout out. The drummer of Hockey Teeth, I think, was the drummer.
Oh, yeah. It was Hockey Teeth. Yeah, it was the guy from Hockey Teeth. You're totally right. Yeah good memory, guys.
And you guys played Spiderland Acres, too, which we talked about last time.
Whoa,
the show.
I still have the code.
Yeah, Spider-Man. Yeah. Yeah. There's things that I saw that night that I can't unsee.
Yeah. Me too. Yeah. Did we actually even play it?
No. Set never came up.
Yeah. It kept on getting pushed back. It was like, you're going on at midnight, you're going on at 2, you're going on at 5. And we were like, what the fuck? And we like, we're driving because there's like a camp area and then the stage area. And we had to drive to the stage area. And the way I remember it is that, like, I was really nervous about the whole thing. Is like, I have anxiety issues, and I was like, this is not it. I do not want to be here. And we pulled up, and I remember the sound guy was like packing up the PA, and we were like, what are you doing? We're playing. He was like, no, you're not. I'm going. I'm fuck this. I hate this place. And he was like packing up the PA. We're like, we don't have to play.
Yeah, we didn't want to play at that point. And we'll skip the story that I remember that was on the drive down there, because I think I told Damien last time, and it's disgusting. And I won't retell it. Yeah, they can listen to the other episode if they want to hear.
Damien,
the story.
You can cut it in from the last episode.
I'm gonna repost the other episode with this one in that way, so people can be brought abreast to all this stuff again.
And I think we played a show in Toronto that same week. I think we played a show in Toronto at a little bar, some sort of like, you know, kind of just kind of regular old punky kind of bar place. I don't know what it's called. You might remember, but maybe we played with Closet Monster.
You did play with Closet Monster downtown.
Yeah, downtown. It was downtown. Maybe, Toronto.
But I thought they were still their other band they had before they became.
They might have been. Monster, yeah. Because I think we played with Closet Monster at a house party in fucking Idaho or Montana like 2 years later. Like, and they were the same guys, but they changed their name to Closet Monster. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they were definitely influenced by the baby dreads that Paul had.
We don't talk about the baby dreads.
I remember what I've forgotten. I have the striped shirts from the Snowball video in my possession right now. Yeah, I do. I cleaned up my parents' basement the other day, and it's just like a treasure trove of. I saved like every fucking poster and all the shirts, and I got like 25 DBS shirts, man. Like, I got so many. So
I need a Piss Bomb the Nation shirt.
Again, I have one.
Oh, my brother stole mine, and then I could get traded to one of his friends. And I.
What size are you? What size are you?
XL, but I could make it work.
I think I have XL. I think they're only XL. Mm-hmm.
I bought that and the Crap Records Jesus Should Have Been Aborted shirt.
Nice. I remember that shirt. I actually, my art teacher in high school I was wearing that shirt in high school and, you know, trying to get as much attention, negative attention as I could. And then he came up to me. I remember this was like a real lesson in the way you approach things. Cause I, you know, he came up and I was like really combative right when he was approaching, cause I could see on his face, he was going to say something, you know? And he was like, "Hey, would you, as a favor to me, take that shirt off for my class?" And I was like, it completely disarmed me. And I was like, "Yeah, okay, sure." And I went to my locker and got like a different shirt and put it on. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting. Like, yeah. I was looking for a fight, right? I wanted him to be like, "Hey, you can't wear that." And I'd be like, "What the fuck not? Go, you know, blah, blah, blah." But yeah, he approached it in this like very friendly way. And I was like, "Oh yeah, why am I wearing this shirt?" Actually.
And cool. It is obviously a very combative statement.
Pretty intense.
I know that wasn't you guys putting that shirt out, but at the same time, like, you guys, you know, like, homophobia is a crime and you're a criminal. Like, you guys were exposing kids to, you know, political stuff. Like, it was a very political awakening for me. Yourselves, propaganda as well, like, hearing these bands singing about this stuff. And this is juxtaposed with, you know, Guttermouth, like, you know, not to shame them, name them and shame them, but there was a lot of bands that were going on stage saying homophobic stuff at that time, too. So it was a decision that you guys made to go this one way, but the ripple effects of that were ginormous for people.
Oh, that's
like
amazing. I'm glad. Looking back, it feels like it's probably just that, you know, a lot of the things we tried to address are so obvious by today's standards that they seem like a bit. Some of the things I wrote, I'm like, I'm not ashamed of it. I'm like proud of like saying, you know, putting to words certain things, but it seems like a little, I don't know. I guess when you're young, you don't necessarily have the like most poetic way to say something political, you know what I mean? But I'm proud of like that, some of that stuff. I definitely had, I do remember, and I will always cherish this. I want to say we're in like London, Ontario, St. Catharines or something like that. And I was probably maybe 17 or 18, and a girl came up to me after the show and said that, she just was super nice about the, saying that song particularly like helped her, you know, not end her own life. And she was a closeted, you know, person that didn't feel comfortable, and that song like changed her. I was like, I think I started crying. I mean, that kind of shit was amazing.
Well, and I know you're saying it seems obvious by today's standards, but, you know, having queer kids, they still have to deal with homophobic shit. Like it is. And want to paraphrase Gorilla Biscuits, like the coded messages and slowed down songs, things like sometimes you need people to spell it out. Mm-hmm. And like that song title to me is like behind the smile level of just like, yeah, this is important that this got said, and the way it got said, like very obviously spelt out right in the title. Like it was, a cool kind of band to kind of grow up with as a kid. Like, I really feel like you guys being a couple, like a year older than me, I think, like, you know, the next time you guys came and I ran into you, Jesse, in the mosh pit just before a Veil started. Just before Grade played. And I'm like, "Oh my God, you're an Avail fan?" And you're like, "No, well, I like Avail, but I'm here to see Grade." And at the time, I did not get Grade at all. And I was like,
"You weren't an emo guy?"
Not at all. And the effect you guys had on the neighborhood with bringing emo to the neighborhood is immense, because that's when everyone in Riverdale went emo. And well,
crazy. So funny. Yeah, I loved that first Grade album, I remember. I don't know. I was an emotional kid, man. I loved it. It spoke to me.
Well, and it is like, you know, and it's funny because that now is like kind of a commercial sound.
I know.
But it was such an anti-commercial sound at that time. Like, it was so jarring to hear that kind of music start happening, like the screaming and the melodic.
Yeah, and the dynamic range, like the loud to quiet thing was, yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, that's another wave similar to what we're saying about the Green Day to Blink-182, is that kind of like Grade to Evanescence, basically.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's funny.
I skipped the mainstream part of emo because like I said, when I was 20, I was still into punk, but only on a local level, like bands I was recording and actively seeing live and stuff. And Vancouver's got a pretty diverse scene where a lot of bands, different genres of bands will coexist on bills. But when emo kind of came back recently and they were talking about Evanescence or something, I was like, who's that? I was like, oh, there was a whole thing called emo that was like a hot topic thing that I never even heard it. I had no idea what this band sounded like.
Yeah.
I know now.
I think that we were in an age too, where it was like really about like rejecting pop culture instead of like participating in it at all. I think in your 20s, mm-hmm. or maybe as a teenager, I was like a little bit more like interested in everything, you know, like, oh, Nirvana was obviously pop culture and I loved it. So I was into sort of exploring everything. And I think maybe there's almost like a certain jadedness that happens if you've been in that world already for 10 years. By the time you're 22 years old, and you're like, oh, this is bullshit or whatever. So I agree. I don't know any of that stuff. And a lot of my friends here reference bands I've never heard of. And they're all that kind of like melodic emo metal singing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know any of it.
It was interesting because it was like the melodic of Grade, the fashion sense of Orchid, and the politics of like Blink-182.
Totally. Yeah, that was another thing. It had zero politics. It was it was a void of any real message. Yeah, it had this almost like there is this tie to almost like incel culture to me. It's this kind of like a boy, like, oh, nice guys finish last, sad boy thing that I'm like, oh, so cringe, man. I don't know.
Yeah. That is weird too. And it's also funny because, you know, like, Gavin McGinnis was in like a Spaz Out on the Floor band back in Ottawa back in the day. So incels and Proud Boys is the legacy of.
I mean, there you go. Case in point.
I was never surprised, honestly, by that. No, I was never surprised when that movement started. It seemed completely obvious that. That advice and all that stuff would head towards that kind of end up in a
right wing sort of like,
yeah, it always seemed that way to me from the outside. I was like, this is supposed to seem like it's a counterculture, but it's so counterculture, it's not again. And that's a real thing. I mean, you know, people, whatever.
It's interesting though, because it comes out of like ebullition. Basement shows like Sean Scallon, Five Arlington, totally. Ottawa scene, right? Like
totally.
But it's interesting how like it's all punk, but and we're all like in the same place and the same mentality, similar mentalities at one point. But then it's interesting as we grow up, just where the negative side of DIY shows up.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Not that I would say that like those references, like I love Shopmaker and a lot of that, the Toronto, like that sort of veer into that kind of hardcore. I love that stuff, but yeah, I don't know. It could, then the vice happens and there's this sort of like irony that then becomes not irony anymore. Like it's the sort of thing where I think it's seen as punk. So if the norm is sort of like, quote-unquote political correctness, then like punk could mean poking at political correctness almost, and then there's this sort of weird right-wing rise, right? Because those people see that they're challenging the norm when actually they've gone full circle. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
I really noticed it when like in the do's and don'ts of Vice, I noticed that they started having that, which is like do's and don'ts was it started off being kind of like fashion faux pas and stuff like that, which is mostly harmless. But then it started getting into like body negativity or even like calling people in the do's and don'ts. And I could tell, okay, using the word drive song, because that's shocking. Or maybe you're even trying to reappropriate it. Like
the queer community is
reappropriated sometimes, you know. Like I thought that maybe it could be like that. But I was like, well, but if everybody's laughing at someone being called that,
yeah,
you know what I mean, then or maybe you're laughing at them again and you're no longer laughing with them, and that's it changes enough. Back over again. So I was always sort of, that's what always kind of made me suspicious of that movement a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you weren't wrong.
and that's Gavin's section. That was the section that Gavin wrote.
Oh, was it?
That was his, yeah. And it is, have you heard of, do you remember the fanzine Answer Me very controversial fanzine in the late 90s.
No, I actually don't know that one.
They put out a notorious issue, the Let's Hear It for Violence Against Women issue.
Oh, fuck.
Very like, it's in Margaret Cho, when she was on the podcast, talked about how it's a very important cultural magazine in America because it's like the birth of like death culture and all that stuff. But Jim Goad, who wrote that fanzine, is Gavin McGinnis's ideologue. And he wrote a book called The Redneck Manifesto.
Yeah. Mm.
Very flawed book. But that is the, I guess, the Mein Kampf, for lack of a better comparison, for kind of that movement.
Well, the right wingers are doing it right now. I mean, like anti-woke culture. What does woke mean? Woke means socially conscious. So the promotion is that if you're, you know, socially conscious, you're somehow like un-American or un-Canadian or whatever it may be. You know, they're really successfully taking that term and making it a bad thing to be socially conscious. And no matter what you believe, right wing, or you could believe in conservatism or fiscal conservatism, it doesn't matter. You can still be socially conscious. But if you're not woke, you're, you know what I mean? Like that should be something that you want to be. You aspire to be. You don't have to call it a dumb term like that.
Exactly.
Like, you never make a trope out of it. But
the thing is
shocking.
The thing is that those people who are pushing back, or some of them anyway, see woke culture as the mainstream. It doesn't even matter what it is. It's more just like
they
want to be, whereas like woke culture came from a pushback from the mainstream. So it's like the woke culture becomes like, oh, we don't like the main, how mainstream talks about like queer culture and women, so we're gonna like push against that. And it becomes so popular that now the counterculture is against the woke culture. It's just like an endless chain. It just go back and forth forever. I feel like we're all old enough to have seen the pendulum swing both ways so many times. And I'm like,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of punk is playing with things you don't necessarily understand graphically, image wise, lyrically. And this is an extension of that. And it's fucking weird to see people that you think would know better fall into these traps and become these tropes. And then it's interesting though, with that vice culture and that rise of like the other side of it, outside of the, where it led to, but the rise of sort of the hipster thing. And just once again, how like Ache Records is kind of like adjacent to that. Like, I was going through the stuff you guys put out on that label. It's crazy.
Yeah. So it was real weird. I don't know what the fuck I was thinking.
But like awesome stuff like Fortet, Kids 606, like ahead of the curve on like a lot of stuff that.
Yeah, I think that same ethos we were talking about like, I really don't care about like any kind of bigger picture idea or I have no plan. I just heard this and I like it and I'm going to see if they want to do a record was literally the only ethos. There was nothing. The only ethos was to have no ethos. It was just like, I want to make a label that puts out such a diverse scope of music that it hopefully will get people who might like one thing into another thing, sort of the way I was seeing it. You know what I mean? Like, maybe there's a, I mean, Hot Hot Heat was my first release. But then I was putting out like Japanese thrash bands and like a Finnish improvised noise record and stuff. And
Congotronics.
See if that would like help people sort of like, not help people. I'm not sure that pretentious that I think I can change, but like get people into new stuff, you know?
Yeah. And it is like, you know, I'm obsessed with the idea of the cooling of Canada. Cause I think as people that have toured internationally, like Canada culturally, no one cared about a lot of the stuff from out of here, outside of the underground, like Propagandhi and all that kind of stuff. But like, you know, it was like Bryan Adams and then later Avril Lavigne. But there's like this period that kind of starts with the stuff you're putting out on Ache Records and the rise of Vice and the rise of Broken Social Scene. And then, and then it like ultimately kind of leading to where we're at now with Drake being arguably the biggest celebrity in the world. Like it's interesting how that, Ache is a key stop in the cooling of Canada, or like a key moment in the cooling of Canadian pop culture.
If you're suggesting that I have a hand in making Drake the most famous person in the world, I agree.
I think it leads to it in a weird way. Like, I don't think Americans take Drake seriously as a rapper. Obviously the Lil Wayne endorsement, but even before that, like, I think, you know, like Canada being a place that actually cool music can come from.
Yeah.
In the critical sphere was not something that really existed
before him. I mean, yeah, the pop stars were like Bieber and stuff, who were like, who were huge, but not cool, you know?
Celine Dion, Ryan Adams.
And, yeah, sure.
You know, not aspirationally cool celebrities. No one grew up being like, fuck, one day I'm going to be Bryan Adams.
Yeah, literally no one.
I love his songs, but, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a funny label, and I had friends. It literally started because I was making a kind of a weird amount of money through my brother, and I had a disposable income, and I had never had it before, and I had no idea what to do with it. And I saw Hot on Heat play way back before it was, you know, when Maddie was the vocalist, when they were still like a total weirdo band, and I loved it, and they had one demo tape, and I was like, can I press a 7-inch with that? I can afford that. And I put it out, and it sold like hotcakes because it was right when they signed to Sub Pop, and I was like, running a label is fucking easy. I just like pressed this record, and it just flew off the shelf. And then, you know, 24 releases later, I'm like, it wasn't that easy. Actually, that was just beginner's luck, I guess. And then I did that Death From Above record, and that was huge too. So those are the two that like let me put out the super weird shit, basically.
And then didn't Street Sense do something about Ake Records at some point? Or I think they remember them. They did something about like the DFA Alexa on Fire tour. And I thought I remember them talking about Ake Records in that.
Oh, man. If they did, I don't remember. But Death From Above were very kind to me. I have to say they were very supportive of the label. Every time I saw them play, they would like do a shout out and say that like they wouldn't be a band without me, which is fucking nonsense. They had already recorded the record. I did not pay I had no money to like support them. I literally just put it out, and it was like destined to be heard by people. So I literally did nothing, but they seem to think I am some kind of saint that got them somewhere, and that is not true at all.
Sebastian puts you over huge on his episode of the show.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's what I mean. There's no need. I mean, I really appreciate it, but I mean, they did to me. They did a favor to me. They made this really great EP that got me enough money to put out other records. That to me, you know, that music spoke for itself, in my opinion. And they were big for a reason. I wasn't a PR company. I did nothing.
Well, I think it's like the effect of DBS on my generation of kids and the music that we wound up making, and then the post DBS careers you guys have had in music, obviously Jesse recording all these bands and being such a key person in kind of that Vancouver explosion that happened a couple of years ago that sort of like shook everything. And obviously the stuff you did with Ake too, Andy, it's like kind of like one of the most influential punk bands in Canada. Like, you know, DOA, as we talked about, inventing hardcore, inventing touring. But like the ripples you guys have had, even outside of the band, is immense.
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, it's hard for me personally to see that because we're just sort of doing whatever, you know. But it's really nice to hear that from somebody who's paying attention, I guess.
Who spends way too much time thinking about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean. We don't sit around worried about it, that's for sure. But it's nice to hear. But I think it's just like, yeah, when you make media for like a really long time, you know, no matter what kind of media it is, podcast too, it's or playing any kind of band, like it just accumulates over time. And you know, like, I mean, I was like bands that I record and stuff, like sometimes they ceremoniously break up, and it's just like, don't break up. Just take a break and, you know, come back and make some more music when you want to. Like, nobody really needs you to break up. Like, you can just do things when you want to do them and not do them. But the more of it you contribute and the more of it you do, the more like little ripples and the more chance you have for little ripples that come out into the wash. So that's kind of, yeah, it's neat to see looking through all my parents' stuff in their basement a few weeks back and finding all the DBS masters, all the multi-tracks. Like, I have everything, basically. Cool. Yeah. And I just like, and all the handbills, that was the one that's really crazy.
I remember walking around show. When you said that about at the Fugazi show, I have like a distinct memory of like a stack of handbills, like 5 yeah. inches thick with like a rubber band around, like stretched to its limit, and just like handing out. We're like, oh, maybe we could hand out. We could probably hand out like 1,500 handbills. Like,
yeah. Oh, I know.
So many.
It was fun. Yeah, there's some really, really cool people in Vancouver that also I think inspired us all to kind of be DIY and taught us how to put on a show and do. Totally. You know, do sound or whatever, like Cecil English, who recorded our records, was really helpful for me and getting me over the line to kind of being my job, doing my job as a professional and stuff like that. And he's still a friend of mine. We hung out last summer. He lives up in Powell River, same as Jason Schurz, who wrote that book I was talking about. And I was up in Powell River. He runs a punk nightclub up there, actually. Yeah. Him and Donna, who ran the town pump and the Commodore for 25 years are a couple. And they've been putting on, they put on Dead Bob and DOA and, you know, other cool stuff in Powell River. He's 73 or something, and is still doing live sound, recording bands, and putting on shows. Yeah.
That's awesome. His hearing must be fucking awful. I remember, like, mixing our album. You'd mix so loud. Do you remember
how he is a loud mixer.
He would blast music. I was like, how are we mixing this so loud?
Yeah. Man.
He's just like is losing his hearing. I'm not sure if that was some kind of engineering choice to be like, what does it sound like at this volume? But I don't know.
It ain't my choice. I don't listen. I've never turned the volume up past 9 o'clock.
Right. You know? Yeah. Again, going back to like when you're young, when you witness something, you just assume that's how it is. You don't know. You have no frame of reference. I just thought that's how loud you mixed an album until I saw somebody else, and I was like, oh, you just listen to it at a regular volume.
It's normal. Yeah. Normal is actually the best volume to mix a record. There's no question about that. Yeah.
I should have said that Cecil English actually, I think he was in the Moral Lepers, which was on that label I was trying to remember earlier, which is Mo Da Mu Records.
Oh, I don't think Cecil ever played music. He probably produced bands.
Maybe then you just produced that record. I know he had credit on that album.
Yeah.
He did lots of stuff. Like lots.
He did all the SNFU records.
SNFU, No Means No, Jello Biafra, DOA, like a million awesome things. Yeah. I mean, No Means No Wrong is the best sounding Canadian punk album of all time. Still has not been surpassed, and he produced that. So Wrong is the best drum sound on any Canadian record ever.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, now you're making me think. This is going to have to be for part 3, Jesse. I'm going to have to like come back with some some other contenders to give the East Coast some sway on this thing.
Come to me. I won't auto-tune your vocals, and I will make the drum sound like No Means No.
I want it. Well, yeah. Like I think one of my one of the worst things that got derailed by the pandemic on a personal level was the fact that I was going to come out and record with you. And so
I wish that could happen. It's not too late. You should have said. I mean, I regret not making it to your show the other night. The reason why is because I had a very special event. I was invited to celebrate that night, which was the completion of a record that I worked on for 3 years, that finally got approved for mastering. So I'd had that night. Superchunk is actually one of my all time favorite bands. So it was a tough pill to not be able to make it to the fucked up Superchunk show. But I did have something else really important in my work life going on that night that I couldn't sell everybody out on. Let's say that. So yeah.
Well, next time we come through with Superchunk, we'll go to the Acid Store. Buy some acid and watch Super.
I'll take you to the Coca Leaf store, man. They make you a cocaine latte. It's fucking awesome.
It's the same store.
It's the same store. Yeah,
it's the same store.
I had a band from Bulgaria come and record with me, and I've been to Bulgaria and I've recorded a record in Bulgaria before, so I know what it's like there. In Bulgaria, you can drink anywhere you want, and you're probably locked up for the rest of your life if you get caught doing drugs. So when the Bulgarian band came to Vancouver, I picked them up at the airport and I said, okay, now I know it's going to be hard for you guys to understand, but in Vancouver, drugs are legal and alcohol is illegal. I was don't drink. Yeah, they were walking on the street drinking a beer. I'm like, what are you doing, man? Are you fucking nuts? Day one, they went to the acid store and scored a bunch of fucking mushrooms and acid and brought me a coca leaf latte. And I was like, they're like, this place is weird, man. I was like, yeah, Vancouver's a weird place.
It is a very weird place. Red tape city.
Red tape, unless you want to open an acid store.
Exactly. Yeah, red tape.
Green light city.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to drink a beer on the beach, you know, there's some red tape. But if you want to sell acid at an actual store, it's all good.
Go ahead. Get in on that. That's why it's such a fun city. Good sushi and acid and great records.
What more do you want?
Yeah. The city that brought you the mescaline analog store and pointed sticks.
The pointed sticks, yeah, exactly.
This has been awesome. And anytime you guys want to come back on together or separate, and you want to get your ego inflated by me, please let me know because I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, I feel great. I feel better than I have in years right now.
Fuck, man.
You ended PBS
homophobia in Ontario, Andy. Homophobia was mapping in Ontario until you wrote that song.
I made Drake, man.
And you got Drake famous, which is really nice for him. Yeah. He's got his own jumbo jet, you know. And
you're responsible for the cooling of Canada.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that sounds bad, but I don't. Is that?
I think it makes it, you know, if you're taking responsibility for Drake, you got to take responsibility for the cooling of Canada a little bit.
Okay. Okay. Well, if it ends with Drake, I mean, I get it. With Drake.
Yeah, it all ends with Drake. It's all downhill from there.
Yeah. And Damien, make sure you message me your address where I can send you something. I'm going to send you a little present.
Save big at Menards. Discovering the perfect paint for your home has never been easier with Zinsser's Smart Coat. Plan smart with interactive tools at smartcoat.com. Buy smart, in-store or online, for home delivery. And paint smart with this advanced paint and primer in one. Save big on Zinsser's Smart Coat at Menards. America's number one home improvement retailer for customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power. For J.D. Power 2024 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Save big money at Menards.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.